Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oh, happy Friday. It's Friday, right? Okay, good. Happy Friday to you. Should be a good show for you today. You know, in the scheme of things. Our good friend Mohammed Sahimi will be back on the show. It's been a little while since we've heard from him, but he's got a new one for antiwar.com that'll be running on Monday. And, yeah, well, I really liked it. It's called A Compromise with Iran is Possible if it is not asked to surrender. That is going to be great. Mohammed, he's great. So just hang around for that. And then also, our friend Sheldon Richman will be back on the show to talk about, well, a couple of things. This article sort of starts a little Ukraine-y, but then it's really more about us. Us being the very vague and very overly broad term for the Americans. And back through history. So that should be good. That's on the subject of Sheldon's TGIF column. The goal is freedom. Ha! You thought he was talking about Friday. No, the goal is freedom. Sheldon's weekly column for the FFF, and we'll be talking with him about that. Now, let me say again, because I said it the other day, but I sort of think maybe I didn't say it good enough. I am so grateful for this lady, Joanne, who is sending in transcripts of the interviews. I've had volunteer transcriptionists come and go. The ones who are really talented and can knock it out and get it pretty much right on the first try, they are few and far between. And what's the point of having a transcript that you got to go back over and over and over, right? Forget it. But Joanne, she's one of those with the talent. Blam, she just knocks them out. And so for the last quite a few interviews there in the archives at scotthorton.org/interviews, you can find the transcript. And that also means then that, you know, if you like listening to the podcasts and you think, oh, wow, what a great quote. If only there were a transcript of this where I could quote this and show it to my friends over on the Facebook or just wait a day. Not even sometimes. And Joanne will have the transcript up. She's really knocking them out and doing great. So, as I mentioned before on the show the other day, it really is a terrible misfortune has befallen Joanne's friend Taryn. She's the one who's the fan of the show, is Taryn. And she lost her hearing. And then get this, she likes the show enough, she's asked her friend Joanne to transcribe it. And Joanne is so damn good at typing that she said, all right then. And so I get transcripts of my interviews as a side effect of all of that. Isn't that something? Again, you know, I wish Joanne would get her hearing back immediately, even if I never get another transcript. That would be fine with me. I'd rather have my listener back. In fact, even if she never listened to the show again, still would rather have her hearing back. But, geez, I guess if one of my fans has to lose their hearing, or one of the show's fans, I guess I should say, happens to lose their hearing, at least I can get some transcripts out of it. Is that wrong? Anyway, Joanne volunteered, hey, I got these transcripts, would you like them? Hell yes, they're already being done already, so okay. How wonderful of you. So there you go. ScottHorton.org/interviews, now we got transcripts up. Very cool. And so sorry to Taryn, and thanks again to Joanne for that. Let me see here. Not seeing it. No, it's no showtime. Oh, yeah. No, don't worry about it, Dave. What's going on is I've got, Adam is just putting the more breaker in there, and that's working, I think. Oh, the last five. Yeah, well, you know, it takes a little while to catch up on the transcripts there. That's the thing. I do a lot of interviews, man. Yeah. When I'm on the ball, 3 a day times 5, that's 15 a week. That's a lot of transcripts. And she's doing the whole show, too. She's not doing just the interviews. She's doing the whole show archives. Although I haven't seen those transcripts yet. But that's all right. Haven't said anything worth transcribing yet, I don't think, since I knew that. But anyway, that's a hell of a thing. All right, so John Kerry is... John Kerry is in London and pissing me off. Don't you hate John Kerry? I mean, anybody who lost a presidential election to George W. Bush has got to really have some flaws. I mean, really? You couldn't beat Bush. Pathetic. Anyway, so this loser, John Kerry, is currently our Secretary of State, and he's over there meeting with Lavrov in Russia, but he might as well have not met him. As far as I can tell, his position is that the Russians must meet with the Ukrainians right now, except that what incentive did they have to do that? That's like, yeah, Assad must come to terms with the rebels right now. Really? And if he doesn't, what? Right. Nothing. He's winning the war and is going to win it anyway. So why would he do what you say? Same kind of thing here. The Russians have no reason to negotiate with the people in Kiev. The new junta ruling Kiev. And so why would they? Just because John Kerry said so? That's the best plan. They can't come up with something. And then, the next thing he said was, I was not able to watch his entire press conference, but his next point was that referendum coming up this Sunday in Crimea is wholly and completely illegitimate, unconstitutional, and illegal. America sides strongly with the coup d'etat junta in Kiev, which overthrew the democratically elected government under the slight pretense, I'll admit, the slight pretense of constitutional process, but no, not really. They impeached him, but only because Nazi stormtroopers had seized all of the public buildings, and the government was basically just frozen out of power. And they didn't go through the constitutional process to impeach him and remove him and hold an investigation and let him defend himself and any of the things in there at all. They just called it an impeachment as they overthrew his ass. It was a coup. Almost pure and simple. The only wrinkle, the only almost in it is that, yeah, there were a lot of people in the street and a lot of people who didn't show up in the street but still hated Yanukovych and wanted to see him gone. But they weren't the ones who overthrew him. Well, the Nazis among them, yeah. The right sector thugs. They helped in the overthrow. But the other people, they were just window dressing. They were just the set pieces for what was an American and European coup d'etat against the Yanukovych government, which was accomplished mostly by the threat of sanctions against all the billionaires and oligarchs. That they better get rid of this guy before it's too late for them. And, of course, yeah, the neo-Nazis seizing the public buildings at the time. But John Kerry's position is, we stand strong and united behind the legitimate government in Kiev, which is only trying to live up to the democratic aspirations of its people. And yada yada, and etc. like that. You buying it? Oh, and by the way, we are totally against any vote. We're for neo-Nazi putsches. How do you say, what's the plural of putsch? Putsches. We're all in favor of a coup d'etat led by guys with SS lightning bolts and even Confederate flags. You gotta love that. Massachusetts Democrats coup led by guys with Confederate flags and Iron Crosses. We're all for that. But a vote in Crimea to see whether the supermajority of the people of Crimea want to secede from the Union and or join Russia that they belonged to for 250 years before. That is wholly illegitimate, illegal, and unconstitutional, according to the President of the United States, whose business it isn't. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show, The Scott Horton Show. And like I say, Mohammed Sahimi's going to be here in just a few minutes. And then Sheldon Richman. He's got plenty of good stuff to say as well. And we'll be talking with him. Well, hang on now. I'm updating my Facebook and my Twitter. Hey, if you want to like me on Facebook, I'm facebook.com/ScottHortonShow. But don't forget to click get notifications or you won't get any notifications. And even if you do click get notifications, you still won't get any notifications. You're just going to have to lurk around my particular Facebook page because I just won't show up in your feed. They're trying to extort money out of me, but I ain't going to let them. But anyway, facebook.com/ScottHortonShow. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, they'll show you my tweets over there on Twitter. I don't think they have a thing where they refuse to show my damn tweets to people unless I pay them. What? If people are following me, they're following me, right? They wanted the updates. I thought. Anyway, on Twitter, you can retweet me at twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. And then also I'm on YouTube. If you like watching my speeches, I'm over there at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. That's Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, /ScottHortonShow. And by the way, we finally got the archives going, all the interview archives all the way back to 2003 up. We had a 2003, 4, 5 were missing there for a little while. A couple from 6. Anyway, they're all back up now. And so now what's going to happen is on the YouTube channel, we're going to go ahead and back up every single freaking interview on the YouTube channel at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. Maybe, hopefully, make a little bit of Google ad money off of that or something. But that's, you know, it's a funny thing. On YouTube, they'll let you do all kinds of stuff. But they will not let you choose the order of your playlist. The order of your playlist, apparently, is simply order uploaded. So we didn't want to start uploading in the middle of the archive and then have to backtrack. We want to start at the beginning and go all the way through. So, our good friend Casey over there, somewhere in Western Europe, I don't know where the hell he is now. Vagabonding it around Western Europe right now. He's going to get on that soon. That's going to be rad. That'll be at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. Okay, good. And then, yeah. So here's the thing that I need to say to you is to read Nick Terse. And I guess I owe y'all an apology, because damn it, I just can't get a hold of Nick Turse to save my life. And I think he likes me. I interview him about all the stuff that he writes as much as I can anyway. But he only answers about a quarter of the time, and a lot of times that's no. But he's just a busy guy. He's now the managing editor, head boss editor at Tom Dispatch. And I think he may be writing a book now about the Special Operations Command. He certainly has been writing a hell of a lot about it. And man, Nick Turse, he's just great. He's the guy that wrote The Complex. Because the problem is, remember how Ike Eisenhower wanted to make it the military-industrial-congressional complex? And they decided, one, it's too many hyphens, man. And two, it sounds like the president is saying that the legislative branch is a threat to the republic and that more power ought to be centered there, when that's not what he's saying. So they didn't want to confuse the issue. So, you know, to benefit the executive at the expense of the legislative branch. So they dropped it. But anyway, Turse says that, listen, his book is just The Complex, because if he called it the military, industrial, congressional, academic, scientific, media, everything complex, then that would just be too many hyphens. But that's what it is now, where virtually every aspect of our society is tied up in American militarism. In terms of, you know, the government forcing open doors for our exports, or forcing open doors for cheap labor and imports from where stuff is made, or holding a gun to countries' heads and forcing them to buy our government's bonds. I guess that's the same kind of thing as forcing open the door to our exports, right? Buy our bonds or we'll burn you to death! That kind of thing. And then, of course, all the vested interests who are just making money, you know, selling the weapons and all of that. But all of that is all inclusive too, right? That means that in the toothpaste business, there's a severe competition for who gets to be the favorite toothpaste of the U.S. Army. We can't let Aqua Fresh win this one, man. Or they're going to have our ass, say the guys over at Colgate, you know? And they double down and they fight to get that government contract. Same for the socks, same for the companies that make the buttons that go on the shirts over there in Bangladesh or whatever it is. It's the military industrial something, 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 something complex. The everything complex. That's, I think, his first book. And then he also wrote Kill Anything That Moves, The Real Story of America's War in Vietnam. And man, especially if you're kind of a right-leaning guy and you don't like people talking bad about your Vietnam War you love so much, or whatever nonsense you've let the conservatives lie into your brain about how we were about to win that war, except that at the last minute, Walter Cronkite and the liberals stabbed us in the back and all that crap. Go and read this. Bottom line, you had no right to win in the first place, ever, at all. It was just murder. Millions of people murdered for nothing. And the whole book is just based on army records of army investigations into army war crimes. So don't come crying to me about what a progressive Nick Turse is when all he's doing is going through the government records. He went and found the box of, holy crap, what is this? Oh my God, look! The motherlode of archives of army investigations into army war crimes during the invasion and occupation of South Vietnam. Bad stuff. I mean, really bad stuff in there, guys. Kill Anything That Moves. You know why he named the book that? It's because he kept finding that over and over and over and over again. Those accused would say, listen, our orders were kill anything that moves between here and there. Anything. So what do you mean? I was supposed to discriminate between what's a target and what's not? I was told not to discriminate. I was told to count bodies, as many as I can. Little bitty baby boys and little old ladies, too. It's in there, man. You read that book, I'm telling you what. And then anyway, here he is, Nick Turse. He's been just great. He's really picked up the mantle, hit the legacy from Chalmers Johnson of who's keeping track of America's empire bases around the world right now. Who's counting them for us year in and year out? It's Nick Turse. now that dear old Chalmers Johnson has died. And Nick Terse is, he's your footnote for how many bases we have around the world, and right now that's more than 1,000. And he's also your footnote for how many nations the U.S. government has its Special Operations Command in, doing training and doing missions. And the answer is 120 out of 193 or 94, depending on how many secessions America is supporting at any given time. You know, when they're not defending the territorial integrity of a little peninsula that has only belonged to the state it belongs to now for 50 years. But anyway, 60. Depending on how many secessions, like Kosovo, South Sudan, or whatever else that America is supporting at any given time, I'm sure they'd support the secession of West Ukraine from the East and Crimea if it came down to that, all of their sacred and holy principles of national sovereignty aside. Somewhere around 192, 94 countries in the world, and America's got special forces in 120 of them. And so, you know, think about that too when you see, well, America spends as much as the rest of the world combined on militarism. As much as the rest of the world combined. Just remember that Russia and China, they're in that top 10, the rest of the top, you know, 9 after us. But they're only, I think, you know, in 5th and 6th place, something like that. 2, 3, 4, and 5, those are all our allies. Those are all the British and the French, maybe the Italians, the South Koreans. And Russia and China, they're not our enemies anyway. That Cold War has been over for 25 years. In fact, the Cold War with Russia, the Cold War with China has been over for 40 years. Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger went over there and shook hands with Mao Zedong and split off China from the Russians way back then. And the Cold War with the Soviet Union has been over since 89. The Soviet Union ceased existing on Christmas Day, 1991, the Cold War was really over even before that. So the worst thing that you could possibly say about Russia and China is that they are our geostrategic rivals, which is a nice euphemism for our empire is encroaching on their territory. But other than that, what, they're frenemies? If you believe in the zero-sum game where China can only gain at our expense, which is retarded, and everybody knows Russia's fallen apart anyway. At least China has population growth going for them, as far as that goes. But, you know, in terms of power on Earth, China doesn't really exercise power overseas, only commercial power. And again, the Soviet Union, or Russia as it exists now, is a small fraction of what the USSR was. And, you know, its army dominates no countries. But, unless you count Dagestan and Chechnya as, you know, would-be independent states someday there in the North Caucasus, they set all of Eastern European and even all the stands free back 25 years ago. So America is spending as much on militarism, including invading Africa, like in Nick Terse's piece on antiwar.com today, as the rest of the world combined, when the rest of the world combined are all our allies, at least our friends, and with the worst of those being Russia and China, who at worst are our rivals and not even enemies at all. It's completely out of control. And if you're an African, emigrate, because we're coming for your ass. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right of the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is the great Mohammed Sahimi. He's a professor of chemical engineering down there at USC in Los Angeles. And he writes oftentimes for antiwar.com, and it's imenews.com. Right, Mohammed?
Correct. Thank you for having me on your program, Scott.
Well, welcome back. I'm very happy to have you here and very happy to see this piece coming out. It'll be running on antiwar.com on Monday, because we want to make sure that it gets, Monday levels of eyeballs rather than weekend levels. We want everybody to see this. It's called A Compromise with Iran is Possible if it is not asked to surrender. And so now here we are, we're in the middle of the process, I guess. We've got the interim deal and we've got basically the lower level processes negotiated all the way through, as far as on the IAEA level, the scientist level, as far as implementing the agreement, as it's negotiated so far, and everything seems to be going okay. But then the question is, on the 17th, when the I didn't realize it was starting again so soon. On the 17th, when the negotiations start again, what's the view of how difficult, what's your view, what's others' views of how difficult it will be to go ahead and see this thing all the way through and get a final deal? You note that there are many, certainly with a loud voice in the media, who are quite pessimistic about how this thing is going to work out going forward from here, Mohammed.
Of course, we know that Israel doesn't want any solution that does not dismantle Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And as I said in my article, it has been trying its best to scuttle and prevent the negotiations from going anywhere. And we all know that about 10 days ago, it claimed, just when Benjamin Netanyahu was visiting the United States to participate in APEC annual meeting, that it has intercepted a large shipment of weapons that were supposedly or allegedly sent by Iran to the Palestinian groups Hamas in Gaza, or perhaps Islamic Jihad in Gaza. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the map and take seriously what the Israelis said, we see that, first of all, the shipment, if it were sent by Iran to Palestinians, cannot go through the sea to reach Gaza, simply because it has to pass through the Suez Canal, and that is not possible because the Egyptians are watching it and Israelis are watching it. So it has to go through land route, first go to Sudan and then go to Egypt, cross the Suez Canal, go into the Sinai Desert, and then eventually reach Gaza. But we know that the Egyptian military dictatorship is an ardent foe of Iran. It has been against any sort of relations with Iran. And these ship weapons that Israel exhibited last Sunday that were allegedly from Iran, they're large. And Israel was talking about a very large shipment. So unless we believe that Iranians were so smart that they could bribe hundreds of military personnel, security personnel, and so on in Egypt so that they can pass that large shipment through Egypt without being noticed, and they also pass it through the Sinai Desert without Israeli getting a notice, then we see that this is just all fabricated and intended to basically prove to the world that Iran is not serious in this negotiation, and its policy under the new president, Hassan Rouhani, hasn't changed, which, in fact, they have changed. And as I said in the article, also we have the report from Reuters claiming that...
Well, now, hold it right there. Let's talk about this Gaza weapon shipment for a second here, because, the so-called evidence that it even came from Iran in the first place, I believe, was a sack of rice with the word made in Iran or from Iran written on it in English, something like that. I'm sorry because I did not follow up on every little bit of news about this, but I read a little bit about it in Haaretz and a couple other places, Mohammed, and I'm under the impression that no one was any more convinced than you're convinced that these mortars were even headed to Gaza at all. Never mind whether that has anything to do with the nuclear deal or whether that should be a surprise or anything else. I think that your doubts here are pretty much the consensus on that issue. Everybody was pretty much doubtful about that, correct?
Well, I agree, because we have had this episode in the past. And in fact, as you said, there may have been some sort of shipment from Iran going somewhere, sending cement or food and stuff or something. And then Israelis fabricated the whole thing. And just to show, as I said, just to demonstrate or show that Iran is not serious and, everything as usual in Tehran, which is actually not true. Iran has actually changed its direction. In fact, the changes that you're talking about in Iran have always been there. The Iranian government has always wanted to reach a compromise with the West over its nuclear program. But it has been the West that has rebuffed Iran at every turn whenever Iran has suggested a compromise over its nuclear program.
Right. Okay, now let's get to this Reuters report, because I thought this was a pretty underhanded little dirty trick what they tried to pull off here.
Yes, I mean, this is, again, not new, because we know, for example, that there are other reporters that always basically plant unfounded exclusive reports in the media, trying to cast doubt on what Iran has been doing or has not been doing. And the latest version of it was what Reuters reported, which claimed that the IAEA had actually new evidence supporting its allegation of its November 2011 that Iran's nuclear program in the past may have had a possible military dimension. And the IAEA was on the verge of publicizing the new evidence, but it decided not to do so because Iran and 5+1 reached an interim agreement in Geneva last December. The report, first of all, was quoted anonymous sources, which is typical of such reports. They never tell us who told them, and probably in this case, for example, somebody in Israel may have said something if there was actually a source, or God knows who. Secondly, it didn't actually say what kind of evidence. It just said something that would support the allegations in the past. Well, the allegations in the past by themselves were completely constructed by many, many people, because those allegations all followed from that discredited laptop story in the past. Supposedly a laptop was stolen inside Iran and taken to the West that contained very revealing materials about Iran's nuclear program in the past. But that laptop story was completely discredited. But Yukio Amano, when he became Director General of IAEA in December of 2009, revived it. Now, even if you take this seriously, the question is, since when Yukio Amano, in my view, has become so concerned about, keeping the negotiations going? The guy has completely politicized IAEA since taking over. There are WikiLeaks documents showing that he's completely allied with the West when it comes to the non-nuclear program. He has always alleged unfounded, baseless allegations in its report, such as, for example, talking about nuclear material in Iran that Iran hasn't declared, whereas he has never presented any evidence that such material actually exists. And now all of a sudden we have a director general such as Yukio Amano, who is actually concerned about Iran and the West not getting negotiations going, and therefore withheld the information. This just defies the whole history of Yuki Amano and what he has done. And in fact, it got so bad that IAEA had actually to deny that it was going to publish any report or to deny that there was such evidence. But the reporters of Reuters didn't even consider the possibility that even if the evidence, some sort of evidence, raw material or whatever we call it, exists and IAEA didn't publish them, it was because probably that even for a guy like Yuki Amano, who has totally politicized IAEA, the evidence wasn't really evidence. It wasn't really credible. It couldn't sell it in any shape or form to the public or international organization. It was just too bad, yeah. Too crude, too rude to do it, and therefore it withheld it. But they didn't even consider that possibility.
It's probably safe to assume that he had opposition from within the IAEA, too, that like, come on, boss, we're not going to go through with this thing. This isn't right, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we know that within the IAEA, there are experts that have been very cautious about how to interpret any data, particularly on a sensitive issue like Iran. And therefore, they didn't even consider that possibility. They just said, yes, there was evidence. IAEA was going to publish it, but it withheld the information and the report because, you know, progress was made, you know, in the negotiations between Iran and 5++. So that was another attempt that we saw in the mass media, trying to present an unrealistic view of what's going on in the negotiations and what Iran wants. Then there is another group of people that always listen to what is heard in Iran and what is said in Iran. And they point to the pronouncement by Iran's Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who always says that he's skeptical about the negotiations with the West.
Right. All right. Hold it right there, Muhammad. We got to take this stupid break here. And then when we get back, more with Muhammad Sahimi about his great new piece for antiwar.com that'll be running on Monday. A compromise with Iran is possible if it is not asked to surrender. Muhammad Sahimi from USC. Back on the other side of this break. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show here on the Liberty Express. And I'm talking with Muhammad Sahimi. He teaches chemical engineering at USC, but also he's a great journalist and columnist as well. IMENews.com is where he writes, as well as antiwar.com, where this one will be running on Monday. A compromise with Iran is possible if it is not asked to surrender. And now, Muhammad, one of the things that you mentioned in here is, I guess, the war party. The only ones who are really complaining, because they'll complain about anything they can to try to, you know, just drum up as much doubt as they can, I guess. One of the drums that they're beating here is that the Ayatollah Khamenei doesn't have his heart in it. He's not really willing to compromise. But you write here that they actually, you know, like he's Ahmadinejad or something, they're basically misquoting him in order to make that claim. Is that correct?
They always misquote him because, first of all, President Rouhani and his foreign minister could not have started the negotiation without approval of the Supreme Leader. Because the Supreme
I'm sorry, Mohammed, let me interrupt you here for just a second. I'm sorry to do it, but let me ask you to hold the microphone of your phone away from your mouth a little bit. It's distorting when you get loud. And I think if you talk nice and loud, but you're not really, you know, blowing on the mic, it should be a little bit better for us, if you could.
Is it there now?
Yes, that's quite a bit better. It's just at the very loudest parts of your speech, it kind of distorts a little bit. We want to try to minimize that. Sorry for interrupting there, but again, you were saying the president couldn't be doing what he was doing unless he had the blessing of the Supreme Leader.
Yes, the Supreme Leader, because he controls the foreign policy, and therefore we couldn't have gotten this far if Khamenei wasn't interested. In fact, Khamenei has always been interested in a compromise solution over Iran's nuclear program. But the misquoting that takes place is regarding what he says regarding negotiations with the United States. What he has been saying is that he even supports negotiations with the United States, but he's skeptical that Iran and the United States can reestablish diplomatic relations based on mutual respect and based on non-intervention of the United States in Iran's internal affairs. In this regard, without meaning to defend his regime in Iran, and God knows that I don't like his regime in Iran, I agree with him, because the United States is not interested in a mutually respectful relationship with Iran. If we look around in the Middle East, for example, and North Africa, we see that every war that the U.S. has started or has taken side in that war, if it didn't start, it was just based on the intention of controlling the resources of those countries. Invasion of Iraq, for example, attack on Libya, for example, intervention on the side of the opposition in Syria and Lebanon. These are all for controlling and intervening in internal affairs of those countries and controlling the resources of those countries, at least in the opinion of people like me. And therefore, why should we believe that the U.S. is interested in anything other than that in Iran? So the misquoting is regarding nuclear negotiations on one hand and a bilateral relationship between Iran and the United States on the other hand. Khamenei has always been skeptical regarding the latter and has always supported the former. So this is another case. And in fact, Ali Larijani, who is the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament and he's very close to Khamenei, was recently quoted saying that what Khamenei is skeptical is diplomatic relations with the United States, but he fully supports the negotiations, the nuclear negotiations with the 5+1 because he really wants to reach a compromise solution. Right. At the same time, as I quoted in my article, Mohammad Fouzandeh, who's a former defense minister and who's also an appointee of Khamenei to several important state organizations, and is very close to Khamenei also, just like Larijani, also said recently that the state has decided to close Iran's nuclear file, which means that Iran has decided to reach a diplomatic solution with the West so that the nuclear issue would go away, so that government can concentrate on rebuilding the country. Right. So these are all clear indications that Iran actually wants a compromise solution, provided that the West stops demanding too much and recognize the realities on ground. Now, on the other hand, we can also, for example, interpret Khamenei's negative statement as, talking to his domestic audience. He is the ultimate power in Iran. So, therefore, he's maneuvering to put himself in a position that if negotiations fail, and if they fail, I believe it would be because the United States and its allies want too much. If the negotiations fail, he can say, well, I told you so. I knew that this may happen. And at the same time, Iran also has hardliners, just like the United States has hawks and hardliners. And I discussed this in several articles over the past couple of months, that Iran also has hardliners, and they also don't want any nuclear agreement with the United States and with the West. And therefore, Khamenei, just like President Obama here, has to control his hardliners, his heart, and appear resolute and strong in order to be able to advance the negotiation. We know in this country, Obama, John Kerry, and others have been doing the same thing. They always repeat that all options are on the table. Obama has emphasized that 90% of the economic sanctions against Iran have never been lifted. and they will not be lifted in the near future. Wendy Sherman, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, has insulted Iranians many, many times. A few months ago, before the Geneva negotiations, she said that deception is in Iranian leadership DNA, which is a totally racist comment in my opinion. And right before the latest round of negotiations in February, she said unilaterally, and God knows based on what knowledge, that the United States knows that Iran doesn't need a nuclear reactor in Iraq. And the United States knows that Iran doesn't need a uranium enrichment site in Fordo, which was built under mountain. Well, right. Even if the United States does know what Iran wants and wants.
In other words, what you're saying, Mohammed, is everybody's got to say something right-wing so that they have a position to back down from. Okay, I'll tell you what. We'll give up our reactor if you stop threatening to bomb us and lift up some sanctions, whatever. Otherwise, I mean, I think it's pretty clear since everybody knows that the whole thing is a big fake crisis and they never were making nuclear weapons or never meant to in the first place, that really it seems to me the only reason that the Iranians have even built up their civilian program as much as they have is so that they have something to negotiate away, right? Like, especially if you look at the COM facility and all the 20% enrichment. I mean, I know they needed it for their medical isotope reactor and all that, but they were... You know, they seemed intent on doing it so that they would have it as a bargaining chip, as Gareth Porter put it, something to give up. So,
I totally agree, because the ultimate goal of Iranians is national security and territorial integrity and non-intervention in Iran's domestic affairs. Therefore, in order to be able to negotiate with a bowling power like the United States, they have to have some winning cards. And therefore, some of the nuclear infrastructures that they built, such as uranium enrichment sites at Fordo, was for that purpose. The Iraq reactor is necessary also because they need for medical isotopes, but Iranians intentionally building it larger than usual research reactor because they also want to use it as a winning card in their negotiations to get the sanctions lifted and to stop threats against Iran. So everybody has some cards that need to play, and only through negotiations and compromises, Iran can give up some of its winning cards in return for major concessions by 5+1, and in particular the United States.
I got to tell you, Mohammed, I'm optimistic. What about you?
I am totally optimistic. I think that we will see a comprehensive diplomatic agreement over the next several months. Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif told Catherine Ashton just last week that Iran believes that an agreement can be reached in 4 months. So even if it is not 4 months, maybe a little longer than that, but I'm very optimistic that the diplomatic solution will be reached.
Right. I mean, after all, again, it's a manufactured crisis, as Gareth puts it, a fake crisis over a program that never really was about weapons. So for the Democrats to bring this up in the way that they have and attempt to solve it through a comprehensive deal, the degree to which they've already pushed this seems to be, you know, the degree of their commitment. And that's a lot. That's pretty far and quite a bit, right?
And at the same time, I believe that the Obama administration may have realized that without Iran's help, the Middle East will not be stabilized. I mean, there is no way in hell that they can stop the civil war in Syria without Iran's participation.
Right.
And without Iran's help. There is no way in hell that Iraq can be stabilized without Iran's help. U.S. forces, if they are going to leave Afghanistan, they need Iran because Iran knows the country. Iran knows all the groups. Iran has worked with all the groups. And therefore, Iran would be basically the protector of Afghan people against the return of Taliban. And I believe the Obama administration has recognized this. And therefore, in order to get Iran help in other important issues in the Middle East, they first need to reach a compromise with Iran over its nuclear program. And Iran will have the United States if the sanctions are lifted.
Right. All right, everybody, that's Mohammed Sahimi. Thanks very much for your time, Mohammed. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Scott.
All right, everybody, that's Mohammed Sahimi. He's at USC, and he's the author of this new one. It'll be running on Monday at antiwar.com. A compromise with Iran is possible if it is not asked to surrender. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And guess what? I got Sheldon Richmond on the line. Hey, Sheldon, how the hell are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us again on the show.
My pleasure.
All right, so...
as always.
You wrote some things, as per usual. And
yeah.
I want to talk about the one before last. First, if that's all right, how Americans can help Ukrainians. I know you're one of these lousy peaceniks who thinks that the U.S. federal Uncle Sam should not go and make everything perfect in the world, whatever your problem is. But so what can Americans do if not wage war against Russia in order to guarantee the sovereign sanctity of the borders of the Crimean Peninsula?
Three words. Open the borders. And then open the bookstore. That's out of business. Let any Ukrainian who wants to get out of there come here. Now, I'm not saying they'll all move, but it's an unpleasant neighborhood to live in. I wouldn't want to live in the shadow of Russia, and I think we should make it possible for any individual who wants to leave, either temporarily or intending it to be permanent, to do so. It's inhumane for us to basically lock people in unpleasant and miserable circumstances.
Yeah, it's like Bob Higgs says, don't just stand there, undo something. So we don't have to ask our government to do anything, just stop excluding Ukrainians from immigrating here if they want.
I agree. That's a position. I think it's an important thing that should be done. I don't think just for Ukrainians, as I say in the article, but instead of talking about loan guarantees or possible military confrontation, which would be hurt lots of innocent people, that's one thing that we're at least, that's a micro solution, a micro approach. Let individuals decide if they want to get out of there and what better place to come than here.
Yeah. By the way, what else do you think about this Ukrainian crisis?
Well, it's not a threat to the United States, the American people. Russia, is a big regional power and it always will be. I mean, anybody who knows anything about Russian history knows, can understand what's going on there. It doesn't mean I'm a fan of Putin. I'm not. I wouldn't want to live under Putin. I don't approve of his mobilizing his military and sending, getting troops ready or putting them in Crimea, because I don't like militaries. I don't like governments, but I don't like when governments resort to the militaries to solve problems. On the other hand, I think we can understand the context. This is not a first move for world conquest. It's not, it's not Czechoslovakia and Hitler. The West, and particularly the U.S., has done a heck of a lot to put him and the other Russian leaders on edge by moving NATO up to the boundary, up to their borders. This is stuff you've already discussed on your show with other people, but it's quite true. A promise was broken to Gorbachev by Jim Baker on behalf of George H.W. Bush that if the Russians were going to leave Eastern Germany and let Germany reunite and perhaps even join NATO, if the Russians would allow that to happen, then NATO would not move any further east, and that promise was quickly broken. And just about all the former Soviet allies are in NATO now, and they talk about adding Ukraine and Georgia, and they're virtual members of NATO already, because NATO has this thing called Partnership for Peace, and those two countries are in it. That's like a halfway house to NATO, as far as I can see. And so they've done everything to make the Russians nervous, and then they wonder why the Russians act like they're nervous. Mm. No big mystery.
I wonder if maybe the problem is that the smartest foreign policy guy we got in D.C. is Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he's a madman. He's one of these guys who's, compared to the neoconservatives, he's good on Iraq and Iran or something like that, or on Palestine, too. But when it comes to his pathological hatred of Russia, he's no better than Dick Cheney. I'm sure you saw where in Robert Gates's new memoir, I haven't read it, but it's reported that in that memoir, he recounts how Dick Cheney, back at the fall of the Soviet Union, wanted to go ahead and, I don't know what he thought his plan was, but he wanted to go ahead and push for the complete dissolution of the nation state of Russia, break it into as many pieces as they possibly could.
Well, you know, I'm a little disoriented because two guys who have actually written op-eds that were fairly sensible, certainly relatively speaking, were Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger. So my head's spinning.
Well, you know, there were... I think you must be referring to what Brzezinski wrote in the Financial Times, because the thing that he wrote in the Washington Post, I think it was absolutely and completely out of control, saying we have to send military equipment to the Ukrainians, we have to double down, we have to make absolute threats about red lines that must not be crossed when it comes to any further encroachment.
Then he changed his mind, because in the Financial Times, he was talking about how it's possible that Ukraine and Russia could reach an agreement like Finland did with Russia. Which isn't a bad agreement. That's not a bad agreement. I mean, Finland has freedom of action. All they did was promise not to be a staging ground for a military invasion or, you know, a launching of an attack against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been pretty much left alone. So
I saw where Kissinger was pretty reasonable. I was amazed, and I had to double-check my own premises. Wait, I agree with Kissinger. He agrees with me. Maybe something's wrong here. But now it seemed pretty good. But I've seen reference to the Finland piece by Brzezinski in the Financial Times, but the only one I read by him, he was he wrote this right as the Russians were moving into Crimea. Further, they already had bases there, of course, but he was just, you know, blood dripping from his fangs. He is mad.
Well,
he must have
been talking to his son Ian, because I see Ian Brzezinski, that's Mika's brother, on Morning Joe, and he's a real hawk. So. Unfortunately, maybe Ian got to Mr. Zbig. That's too bad.
Well, and, you know, this goes back to his whole thing. We're going to be running a piece about this on antiwar.com this weekend, too, in fact, is about the Grand Chessboard, and which is his book, his strategy for the expansion of the American Empire through Central Asia after the end of the Cold War, where he talks about just how important Ukraine is. He considers, and maybe he's quoting Russians to this effect, that Ukraine is their bridge to Europe and therefore is really the key piece of whether they can be a global power or not, whether they can be an empire or not. If they don't have Ukraine and Crimea and that warm water port there, then that's everything to them, which is why it should be everything to us to make sure to keep it out of their hands.
Well,
you know, he sounds like Bill Kristol, frankly, completely out of his mind.
These people have learned nothing from history, because if they really want to put an end to, you know, Russian activity, and therefore so we never have to worry about it again, they're going to have to nuke them. I mean, what the hell are they talking about? Russia is Russia. It's not going to change anytime soon. And so do we want perpetual war or a final showdown, or do we want to learn to live with it? I mean, come on, grow up, people.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, that's my thing, too, is wait, but H-bombs, right? So that's it. That's the end of the argument. You can only push them so far. What else is there to do? And in fact, I mean, even if they, you know, okay, so what if they expand NATO? I actually learned from that Peter Beinart piece in the New Republic just how much cooperation they already have between NATO and all of the stands, Turkmenistan and Tajikistan and Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, that all of them have kind of NATO partnerships and are working hard on standardizing their military to fit into NATO doctrine and all that kind of thing. There's a point where we might do that so much where, you know, what if somebody to the right of Putin seizes power and decides that, you know, he needs a preemptive strike now before they're never going to be able to get off a shot. And, you know what I mean? They could really push this thing too far. Just, it almost seems to me like they're sleepwalking. I mean, you have the obsessions of the Brzezinskis, but you also just have the special interest type rent seeking of Lockheed and all their push to expand NATO that they've waged this whole time. And it seems like mostly it's a thoughtless policy, right? It's like Victoria Nuland's running the whole game, and they don't even realize what kind of trouble they're risking getting us all into here.
Well, that seems hard to believe. I mean, there's no subtlety about any of this, and I have to, you know, I'm not the conspiratorial type, and maybe this wouldn't require a conspiracy, But it's hard to believe that they didn't know they would get this kind of response. I think people need to also pay attention to Stephen Cohen at NYU in Princeton, who's a Soviet, apologist. He's been one for many, many years. And he's written some very interesting things about this. And it's hard to believe they didn't know that they were going to get this. Now, maybe there's something in it for them. The military is talking about cutting back in the U.S., so this would be a good way to stop that. It's just hard to believe they don't know that they don't have Russian specialists who would say, wait a second, this is not a good idea, and who would hold sway. So I don't know that they're stupid. I mean, a lot of times the only conclusion is that they're stupid. If you look at what they did in Iraq, I can't explain that, but except by sheer stupidity.
Yeah.
But this I think you can explain in another way. And I have a feeling maybe they wanted the fruits of this crisis.
You make an interesting point there. Ted Snyder talked about how it looked to him like they really wanted Yanukovych to have to say no. They offered him a deal that he could not possibly accept. That way, then they would have the excuse to do the push. They would rather not have the deal with the president they don't like, and wait until they can get their guy in there. And
that was very interesting.
If it's that cynical, it could be as bad as you're saying too. They wanted to see the Russians come and take back Crimea just so they can sell more planes for the Latvians or who knows what. Give us a sec. We'll be right back with Sheldon Richman in a moment, y'all. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And by the way, that Brzezinski piece I was talking about where he's completely flipping out is in the Washington Post. It's called What Is to Be Done? Putin's Aggression in Ukraine Needs a Response. And here he says, much depends on how clearly the West conveys to the dictator in the Kremlin a partially comical imitation of Mussolini and a more menacing reminder of Hitler that NATO cannot be passive if war erupts in Europe. Pounding on the damn desk as he wrote this thing, as he dictated it to his secretary.
His kids, Mika and Ian, got to him. It sounds like it. Sorry to say.
Man.
You got to stand up to your kids sometimes, Mr. Zvig.
And this is the guy who went before the Senate back in 07 and said, you want to have a war with Iran? Let me tell you, you're going to be occupying all the land from Israel to India, stupid. You can't. Knock this off right now. And the senators were like, oh, I guess we hadn't really thought of that. Or something. They really reacted like, I was instructed that I'm supposed to listen to things that you say, Mr. ZB, and you really don't think so, huh? Okay. Anyway.
Terrible.
All right, so now everybody on Earth is laughing their ass off at John Kerry talking about the sanctity of sovereign borders and how, in the 21st century, even the 20th, you don't just go trumping up excuses to invade other people's countries, Sheldon.
No, you don't. You don't. has he looked in a mirror lately? As I understand it, wasn't he for the invasion of Iraq?
Absolutely. And you know what's funny about that, too, is he's one of the ones who was opposed to the first Gulf War and never lived it down. It was one of the most embarrassing things of his whole life is that he didn't support that wanton slaughter and hurt him politically. And so when it came to 2003, there was just no question of which side he was going to err on.
Yeah. And many people have pointed out, as I say in the article I think you're about to ask me about, many level-headed commentators have said that the U.S. government is in no position to lecture Russia about respecting other nations' borders. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, they think Americans have no historical memory whatsoever. Now, that may be true. Most Americans don't have a historical memory, so they can get away with that. But some of us do. And we've been writing about it, and so maybe fewer Americans lack that memory than it used to be the case.
Right. Well, what happens is we learn in government school that anything our government ever did was justified, and the proof of that is that they were elected. So therefore, through the magic of democracy, it's what the people wanted. Everything they did is what the people wanted. And, of course, the people wouldn't have wanted it if it wasn't the right thing. And so all of American history is exactly how it had to be. Couldn't have been any other way. It was all for the best, like Pangloss.
That's the Whig theory of history, right? It's always onward and upward.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything that's left behind deserves to be left behind. So,
well, so give us some revisionism then. Tell us it ain't so.
Well, it ain't so. And a lot of Americans do understand that the U.S. has not always been on its best behavior. For example, they may know that they may know about Grenada. They may know about Panama, although those have probably been forgotten. But Iraq, maybe they know, remember. They might remember Iraq. It was only way back in 2003. But and some of them may actually know that in 1898, the U.S. attacked Spain in order to grab its colonial possessions like Cuba and the Philippines. And they may think, well, that, and even in school, you're kind of taught that was an act of empire. So that's not totally foreign. If people remember their school years, they may
realize. Yeah, the chapter heading will be The Age of Empire from 1892 through 1902.
then it ended. That's right. But I go back even further in this piece, which you can find at fff.org. It's also on Counterpunch. And it's called Empire on their Minds. And what I point out is that the imperial state of mind goes much further back in American history, not 1898, not 1896 when they started messing around in Hawaii, but 1776. In other words, the founders of the country had empire on the mind from the very start. And I think even some of this you learn in school. They saw, you know, they wanted to expand not only through the whole North American continent, and that, by the way, included Canada and Mexico. They didn't manage to pull all that off, but South America as well. Jefferson talks about someday we'll rule South America, and that there will only be one language. The Western Hemisphere will have one language, one set of laws, one form of government. Of course, they wiped out the Indians. They pushed the Indians, killed the Indians, stole their land, engaged in ethnic cleansing and extermination. That was an act of imperialism. Those were nations, the Indian nations. They were known as nations. And they were on land we wanted. I say we, you know what I mean. On land they wanted. And so it was cleared. It had to be cleared.
I love the way Anthony tells this part of American, Anthony Gregory, of course, tells this part of American history where, you know, the Federalists, the Whigs, the Republicans, same thing. They were always the fascist party, basically, of big business on welfare and internal improvement programs and whatever, like they call themselves all the time, where the Democrats were really the more Republican party of decentralized, limited power. They were also the slave owners and the very worst of the warmongers. From the party of Jefferson and Jackson, and so
they were actually known as the Republicans back then. I know sometimes called Democratic Republicans, right. But the shorthand was Republicans, not Democrats.
Right, but I meant Republican in the small in the small R sense of just having actually a Republican form of government rather than a very centralized one. And yet they were the worst of the warmongers. When it really came down to it, they were more centralist than the Whigs because they were all about the war power. Whereas the Whigs, even, you know, like the North, threatened to secede during the War of 1812, right?
The Northern Federalists were not in favor of the War of 1812. But earlier, the Federalists, don't forget, in the 1790s, pushed the Indian Wars. That was their doing. And in the 1780s, before the Constitution, there were Indian Wars going on. General Anthony Wayne became famous by wiping out Indians, and so that clearing what we now know as the continental United States was an act of empire building. They also had their eyes on Canada and made various attempts. That was one of the objectives of the War of 1812, which Jefferson backed. Mm-hmm. That was Madison's war. Madison has this eloquent statement about war is terrible, right? It's the seed of all bad things.
Right.
But I don't know if he said that before, during, or after the War of 1812. There was also, there was war in Mexico, because they wanted to grab as much as Mexico. They expected Mexico to eventually to fall in their hands, either by outright invasion or just by a natural process. They acquired, of course, thanks to Andrew Jackson, again applauded by John Quincy Adams, who was Secretary of State at the time, Florida, the territory of Florida, which was larger than what we think of as Florida today. It includes, you know, parts of Georgia, Alabama. It was held by the Spanish. They wanted Cuba. you know, they wanted the Western Hemisphere, and then the Monroe Doctrine was issued. It was written by Quincy Adams under Monroe, which said to Europe, "We'll stay out of Europe, but you stay out of the Western Hemisphere because we will regard any further attempts for you to colonizing it as a threat to our security, our safety, and our democracy." They often invoked security. In other words, the national security state did not begin in 1947. It began in the early days of the Republic. Because, as William Appleman Williams points out in his book, Empire is a Way of Life, when you think you're the chosen people, as the Americans did, right, American exceptionalism, they thought they were exceptional, and in some ways they were. I mean, in overthrowing the British, the people were really established, not the rulers, but the people themselves were establishing a non-hierarchical, non-aristocratic society. That was a change. That was radical. But in thinking you're exceptional, that can very easily turn to a dark side, right? You have to bring enlightenment now to the world. We're exceptional. We now must bring the new way of thinking to the world. And if the world doesn't welcome you, like the Indians didn't, if the Indians don't want to take on your way of life, well, then they're going to have to be moved out of the way or killed. And so that's the bad side of exceptional. It's one thing to think, yeah, we have some ideas that are good for a free society, and people should copy us. It's another thing to think we're going to have to impose it on you, whether you like it or not, because this is the way, and we need to make ourselves safe. That right. was the view. They could only make themselves safe if they turned everyone to, you know, this way of thinking, and at the point of a gun or a bayonet, if necessary.
Yeah, well, you know, we've talked about this before, Sheldon, about how hard it can be for people when they, you know, especially maybe they're new at libertarianism, and then they start applying their libertarian principles, going back through history and looking at all these wars, and it really is asking a lot of them, isn't it, to a lot of libertarians come from the right, too. It's asking a lot of them to say, you know, actually, no, this whole project has been a corrupt project from the beginning. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, they were the guys who ruined the American Revolution, not who, you know, made it permanent through their constitution.
We're all grown-ups. We don't need to tell fairy tales. We don't need to shield people from the truth. The leaders of the country, the new country, the budding country, saw the revolution in large part as a battle between a mature empire and a nascent empire. George Washington referred to himself as a resident of an infant empire. That's what they saw in the future. They thought it was inevitable. They thought it was manifest destiny. They thought it was divinely ordained. But even the secular ones believed that too. And even the ones who were nervous about the methods of empire, and some of them were, Quincy Adams is a possible example. But even the ones nervous about empire knew that it would rest uncomfortably with liberty, still wanted ends that could only be achieved through imperial means. That was the fatal flaw. Even the ones that didn't like empire wanted things that could only be achieved by empire. And so logic pushed them in the arms of the outright imperialists.
Right. And now back to the beginning again, where our frontiers are on Russia's western border over there in Ukraine right now. As Fitzy G puts it in the chat room, quoting Garrett Garrett, there is no security at the top of the world. We've now taken this empire thing so far that we're destroying ourselves with it, setting ourselves up even for the possibility of a real war with a real power that's strong enough to really fight back and win.
Yeah, and I like the line by Adam Gopnik, who says, the worst pretense of empire is that every rattle on the edges is a death knell to the center.
Right. Yeah, that was a great quote. And it's in Sheldon Richman's new piece, Empire on Their Minds, brand new, out today at fff.org. Thanks, Sheldon.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
You started this damn war. Now you have to deal with it.
And we will. It is just a matter of time before we achieve a complete victory.
You know there won't be a victory. Every day your war machines lose ground to a bunch of poorly armed, poorly equipped freedom fighters. The fact is that you underestimated your competition. If you'd studied your history, you'd know that these people have never given up to anyone. They'd rather die than be slaves to an invading army. You can't defeat a people like that. We tried. We already had our Vietnam. Now you're going to have yours.
God, I love that clip so much. That's from, you know that. You've heard that before. That's from Rambo 3. That's Trotman. The guy that always is getting Rambo into trouble and then, you know, saving him from it. First blood, second blood, third blood, lots of blood everywhere, blood. And that's Trotman abducted, captured by the ruthless commie Bolshevik Red Army of Leon Trotsky, at that time working for, what, Andropov? Or already Gorbachev at that point, I don't know. Anyway, captured by the USSR in Afghanistan. And where do you think they got that line about our Vietnam, your Vietnam? Well, you got two choices. Either they got it from the U.S. state who advised them on putting together that movie about American support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan fighting the Soviet invasion and occupation. Or it was just that obvious to everyone. And now I've been bugging you guys to go and look at my excellent speech that I gave for the Future Freedom Foundation on February the 15th at the Students for International Students for Liberty Conference. John Glazer and I gave a presentation called Libertarianism versus the Empire. And one of the terrible flaws in the speech, oh, I've got great excuses. It was all because of the weather and the airlines. I can't read on the plane, and so I wasn't really prepared. So I did my speech the best I remembered it, but I did not have my notes together. What I had was way too many notes that I couldn't possibly use. I needed half an hour to pare it all down into an outline of a speech. So I got there and I winged it, and I completely forgot my entire thing about the Afghan War and Vietnam. And it was going to be, I wasn't going to mention Rambo because I'm not smart enough to have thought of that. I should have thought of that. But I was going to talk about, this was supposed to be part of the speech, but it ended up accidentally on the cutting room floor there. Part of this speech was supposed to be about how Zbigniew Brzezinski, the madman, claims, whether it's true or not, I don't know. Maybe it's at the Jimmy Carter Library or something. If somebody can prove it, I don't know. But Zbigniew Brzezinski claims that when, well, first of all, he claims that, and, you know, I've heard this disputed, too, that he's just patting himself on the back and exaggerating, but I'm trying to remember who disputed it now. Oh, hell, anyway. Brzezinski claims, for good or ill, that it was his idea to sponsor the Mujahideen and start supporting the Mujahideen's war against Najibullah, the commie sock puppet in Kabul, back in 1979. And that his plan was to bait the idiotic Russians into overextending and invading Afghanistan. Not just, let's abandon containment, let's encourage them to overexpand. And it worked. According to Brzezinski, he started, and Gates says this in his book too, he was, you know, number two, number three sock puppet at the CIA at the time, working for William Casey, or, no, I guess he was, yeah, he was already at CIA, but not working for Casey yet. Part of operations. But he wrote this in his book, that they supported the Mujahideen in order to lure the Russians, the Soviets, into invading Afghanistan there in 1979, 1980. And then Brzezinski claims that he sent a note to President Jimmy Carter that said it worked, and now we are going to give them their own Vietnam. So what does that mean? Well, it should be obvious, but just in case it's not obvious, Vietnam, in this case, is shorthand for a horrible, terrible, no-win, bloody, decade-long quagmire of waste and destruction and pain, and which is horribly disruptive to your society back home, too. That's what Vietnam means. a gigantic, stupid adventure you should have never gone on. That's what it means. How do we destroy the Soviet Union? We scrap containment. We encourage overexpansion. And now, I'm not trying to give them that much credit for destroying the Soviet Union. It was falling apart anyway. And the invasion of Afghanistan was pretty much, you know, marginal, I think, in really making the difference. But don't tell the Reaganites that, and don't tell the Bin Ladenites that. Because their point of view is they brought down the entire USSR by fighting that freedom fighter war and giving them their own Vietnam in Afghanistan. But so, if Brzezinski was smart enough to learn the lesson of Vietnam, that shouldn't have done that. Massive blow. The Birchers might as well have been right that America was run by commie simp traitors who deliberately got us into Vietnam just to bankrupt us, just to disrupt everything, just to destroy everything, just to cripple a generation of young men. Just to break America's bank because it was that bad of a mistake that our politicians made in committing to that policy. If you can call that kind of premeditated murder a mistake. But, you know, I think you have to take for granted they did think America was going to benefit from it. They were just wrong about that. But so how can it be that our current empire is run by people who learned, I mean, in Brzezinski, he doesn't run the thing, but Obama listens to him. He's the Kissinger of the Democratic Party. In other words, Rockefeller's man in the Democratic Party. Okay? So, he's around. His wisdom ain't so wise. It's not maybe conventional wisdom for the average Democrat member of the House, but certainly over there at Brookings, where their heads are more egg-shaped, they get the idea, right? Brookings, that's the pseudo-center-left liberal think tank imperialists. Don't they get it? That if invading Afghanistan is a stupid thing for the Russians to do because it's like Vietnam, it's like when America invaded Vietnam, then for those very same reasons, it's a stupid thing for the Americans to do. Here we've been occupying Afghanistan for 12 years. And then look at this from The Guardian. NATO commander warns full U.S. troop pullout will aid al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Well, first of all, there is no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. I suppose it's possible there are, you know, 5 or 10 Arabs who used to be friends with Osama who are hiding in Pakistan somewhere. Maybe even hiding under a rock somewhere in Afghanistan. I don't know. But I don't know by what magic they're supposed to be badder fighters than the Taliban, who they clearly are subordinate to if they exist in Afghanistan at all. And what does this say other than they already failed? I mean, what is it, General? You need another 12 years till 2024, like in the Obama, like in the deal Obama signed with Karzai. America has to stay until the 2020s. Oh, but by then we'll have created a democracy that doesn't need the Americans to prop it up. Who are these people? Why does anyone take Joseph Dunford any more seriously than they would take General Westmoreland saying the very same stupid thing? Oh, well, all we gotta do is just stay longer and kill more, and I'm pretty sure at the end we'll win this here thing. Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure not. How about that? As long as we're making up stuff. It's 2014, and they're saying we can't win, we can't leave the war because we ain't won yet. Could that really be? Are we going to tolerate that from these people, or are we going to make them admit defeat? I think that's what we should do. I think we should make Joseph Dunford, the general, go on TV and take personal responsibility for failing. I guess if he wants to point his bloody hand toward David Petraeus and Stanley McChrystal, that would, and Barack Obama, who sent them there, and George Bush and his administration before that, that would be okay. But I just think it's absolutely intolerable that we have to hear from these people that we've won, but we can't leave yet because we ain't quite won all the way yet. No, you lost. You already lost. You had your chance. And if you haven't trained up an army good enough to rule Afghanistan yet, then too bad. I guess Joseph Dunford is going to be remembered in all of history as being a terrible general who lost a war to a bunch of nobodies. To a bunch of losers with nothing more powerful than an AK-47 to fight with. A bunch of nothing to eat. And I guess that's just going to be how it is. Oh, but Scott, the general doesn't want to go down in history as having lost a war to some civilians with rifles. Oh, I'm sorry. That's what happens when you lose. Sometimes history records it. I admit, not as a rule, but... Here's Westmoreland about winning Vietnam.
Well, the Oriental doesn't put the same high price on life as does the Westerner. Life is plentiful, life is cheap in the Orient. And as the philosophy of the Orient expresses it, life is not important.
I guess we can just keep killing Afghans. They count as gooks, right? Same difference. Apparently they don't mind when you kill their families. We just need to clear hold and build them a little bit better. We'll change their entire society. Ask John Nagle. He'll tell you. Go ask the guys at CNAS. They'll sell it to you.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
That's funny, man. Go back and check the archive from, well, I wasn't here last Friday, but Friday before that. That song's just set for this slot. I didn't just cue it up. It just happens to be that Vietnam is a metaphor for everything horrible in the world. Everybody uses it. Here's old, what's-his-name from Turbo Negro using Vietnam as a metaphor for his heroin addiction. You're my private Vietnam, and I can't stop shooting, he says. He's just stuck in a quagmire of drug addiction. It's his own Vietnam. It's America's foreign policy. That's what we do to ourselves all day. That's what our government does to our society all day long. They get us into Vietnam after Vietnam after Vietnam. And, I mean, I guess that's fun if you like killing people, but for everybody else, what do you have to show for it? Huh? Right. All right. Hey, listen, I should mention this. It's important. Well, there's so many different things I want to mention, man. Well, let me tell you this. Keep looking at antiwar.com. I've got all the bad news there. I'm not really an employee anymore, but I still do a hell. I do more work now for antiwar.com than I ever did, really, now that I think about it. So, yeah, we. Antiwar.com. We got all the bad news for you. And we got all the best viewpoints about all the bad news for you, too. And that's really what my job is. I mean, honestly, I don't go around scouring the internet for them. But other people submit, hey, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this, and here's one I wrote, and look at this, and I'm the one who chooses what goes on the page as far as the viewpoints. So if your article got rejected, take it out on me if you want. But if you want to know what the hell is going on, that's, you know, my favorite stuff. or at least what I really think you ought to be looking at. And the same goes for the links in Justin Raimondo's column, too. I put most of those in there for you. And I pretty much agree with everything he's saying. And so my job there is just showing that he's right, which he usually is. And so that ain't too hard. So if you want to know, what I'm reading, you want to mimic the homework I'm studying, those are the links, man. Antiwar.com, and then, again, especially the links in Justin's columns there. But now, now that I mentioned that, the point there being that even if I don't have a chance to get to all the stuff I want to talk about on the show, you can find it there if you want to read it. And links to my interviews up at the top of the page, too. One of the articles that I believe will be running, it could be running right now, but I think it's going to be running over the weekend, is Mitchell Plitnick. He writes for Loeb Blog, Jim Loeb's blog over there. And he's got this great piece. He's got this great piece at the Loeb Blog about BB's epic fail, as he calls it. Benjamin Netanyahu's recent trip to the United States. As we talked about with Mohammed Sahimi, this kind of failed PR stunt. I don't know, maybe impress the guys over at the Weekly Standard and a couple of fools on Twitter or something. Nobody else seemed to care when he said, oh, look at all these mortars, which, believe me, were meant for Islamic Jihad in the Gaza Strip. I think the common reaction was, even if that's true, Iran never promised to stop backing whoever in the Gaza Strip. That's not part of the negotiations. And nobody ever said that making a nuclear deal with them means that they're angels now. Then again, Hamas won the election. They are the government of Gaza. They're not allowed to have mortars. They're only allowed to have Roman candles, I guess, over there. It's the way that works in the occupied Gaza Strip. The Gaza prison is basically what it is. It's a giant juvenile prison. And nobody was impressed with that. He came and gave his AIPAC speech, as MJ Rosenberg explained on the show. The AIPAC speech kind of fell flat, even in the room there. I mean, he got some applause and all that. But apparently the mood was such that he ended up kind of turning it into a comedy routine. And just sort of jokingly saying, oh, yeah, well, and they must not enrich any uranium, blah, blah, blah. And everybody can just see through it now. He couldn't even get through it without just getting silly. And then, there's his attitude toward the peace talks, which, as Plitnick puts it here, and I think I agree with this, the contest now is who's going to get the blame for the peace talks failing. And what Netanyahu has done, and he didn't need to do this anyway, right? He could have come up with 1,000 other excuses. But what he's, in order to sabotage the talks and make sure they go nowhere. But what he's done is he's staked out this position that the Palestinians must declare that Israel is a Jewish state. They've recognized Israel and Israeli, 67 borders since 1988. The only thing they've been negotiating about is, the occupied territories and the right of return, although that could be put off more or less indefinitely, right? You could even agree in principle to the right of return and then come up with a million reasons to be slow in implementing it or whatever. It's not the highest priority of those negotiating on the Palestinian side this whole time. I think they would rather just have the West Bank and East Jerusalem and then, work from there. I'm not saying they've abandoned it as a principle, but the trying to make them outright declare Israel as a Jewish state is basically de facto attempting to make them forsake forever, even in principle, the argument for an eventual right of return of the 1948 refugees and their offspring. And they're not going to do that. They can't do that for domestic political reasons. And, of course, what it would also do would be a de facto recognition of the justice of the two and even, three-level citizenship, at least dual-level citizenship inside Israel, where Israeli Jews have so many more rights than Israeli Arabs, whether they're Muslim or Christian. And it makes no sense, really, the way that they discriminate. It's like the Jim Crow South, and I'm not even talking about the occupied territories, you know, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, nothing like that, but just inside so-called Israel proper. The way they discriminate, it's like the Jim Crow South, and it's official, it's the law, it's wrong. And they're trying to force the Palestinians. Netanyahu is demanding that the Palestinians recognize that as a permanent fact of life for all the Israeli Arabs, which, again, is absolutely a bridge too far. But here's the rub, as Mitchell Plitnik is explaining it here at Loblog in Bibi's Epic Fail. He says, everybody knows. It's pretty much apparent, even here in America. Maybe the pundit class ain't talking about it, but it sure looks like he's the one who's the jerk here, not them. He's the one who's moving the goalposts and making it impossible. He's the one, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, who clearly is acting in bad faith. There's just no question who's dishonest. Him. There's no question what his motives are. Sabotage. Occupation. Colonization of so-called Judea and Samaria. That's the right-wing nationalist Likudnik plan. Now, you might have noticed I don't throw around the term Zionist too much because I think it means too many different things to too many different people. I thought originally, and I don't know if anybody really thinks this, no, I am pretty sure that some people define Zionism as just a belief that Israel should exist at all kind of thing. And other people think of Zionism as a determination that it should be expansionist and, you know, from the Tigris to the Euphrates and all of this kind of crap. Or at least all the way to the Jordan River and call that greater Israel or, you know, this kind of thing. So I try not to confuse those issues by throwing around terms that, you know, can be defined in different people. By different people in different ways so that it just leads to misunderstandings. But you will hear me refer to Likudnik, right-wing nationalism, expansionism, colonialism, whatever, you know, words that mean exact things to exact people. It's grand theft on a mass scale. They're stealing the West Bank. And for whatever political reasons, they can't steal it all at once. They just steal it a bit at a time. And the Palestinians then are just, you know, some sub-legal, you know, people basically stranded, left behind under some foreign country's martial law in their own country. And anyway, point being, I'm off on the tangent, but point being, everybody can see through it now. They should have kept Ehud Olmert or somebody like him, right? Ehud Olmert, you can barely remember what he even looks like, right? He's just some technocrat. He's just some guy. But Benjamin Netanyahu, he's like the Hillary Clinton of Israel. People just hate him, man. He's such a disgusting, warmongering, dishonest person that he inspires contempt. And he inspires critical thinking. And honesty and integrity. And the other thing is because it's not just how mean he is, it's how stupid he is, as Mitchell Plitnik says here, believing his own nonsense about the unlimited power of the Israel lobby to get things done in America. He has used AIPAC to go up against the American people over and over and over again and has been smacked down lately by the American people and by the American mainstream establishment, which is sick and tired of him. Anyway, it's a great article. I hope you'll read it. It's Bibi's Epic Fail at lowblog.com. See you next week.